Hey everybody, time for another Shop Talk show. This is episode number 279. We're going to get Dave fired up about the likely demise of an HTML5 feature. We're going to talk about the production of podcasts a little bit. We're going to talk about is there like a picture element alternative to the video element, or can the video element do what the picture element does? Like, what's the connection there? Pretty tricky and weird, though. Talk a little bit about work-life balance and many other questions as well, all coming up here on the Shop Talk Show. Dave, please, sir, kick things off.
Shopomaniacs, you're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show with Chris and Dave.
That's right. Just a normal one this week. We're doing a lot of those.
Just a hip hoppy day on the old web. Chris, I almost quit web design this week.
Yeah.
You want to know why?
Well, I think I have an idea why, because you were, we even talked about it a little bit in Slack, and then I think it turned into a Twitter conversation a little bit, is that this, and it relates to an episode just not long ago, a couple episodes ago maybe, where we spent like half the episode talking about web components. Is that where you're going with this?
That's where I'm going with this.
Okay, so it's web components are a thing all by themselves, but there's this library by Google that's that a lot of people who are choosing to go the web components route use, which is called Polymer. And Polymer is releasing 3.0, and that's about all I know about it. You're going to have to fill me in after that.
All right. So Polymer 3.0, you know, it's big Polymer summit happened, I guess, you know, when this episode comes out, a couple of weeks, you know, ago. All in all, I think you should go to the Chrome Developer YouTube channel and watch some of these videos. It's pretty cool. But they kind of just snuck this thing in, the two big things that will be different about Polymer 3.0 is it's going to be on NPM, not Bower. And everyone's like, yay, you know, of course, that's great.
Another nail in the coffin for Bower. That was kind of a weird.
Poor Bower. It was every time you started using Polymer and you like had to like reference Bower, Bower modules or Bower components, it started feeling a little weird, but just because you're using kind of something that feels modern, but then you're like, anyway.
Well, even Bower has been like, no, we're kind of done with this thing.
Yeah, Bower's sort of admittedly iced themselves a bit, but then they said we're moving from HTML imports to ES6 modules.
Mm-hmm.
Which basically means, and here's the hot drama sound effect in 3, 2, 1, ka-chunk.
Okay.
HTML imports is effectively dead. The idea that you can write, like, Polymer was the only one who's really, really using that. Vue kind of has their own, like, Vue files, which are kind of hybrid. But Polymer was the only one really leveraging this idea of HTML imports where you write HTML and some JavaScript. But now they are favoring kind of the, you know, React model of writing JavaScript. And then you have a template function that has a bunch of like output HTML template literal strings.
Yeah.
So you're like return tilde or whatever that tilde slanted apostrophe, whatever that's called.
Yeah, the back tick or whatever.
Yeah. So you're like return back tick, H bracket H1 close bracket. This is my title, you know, close H1 tag.
Which means by the time you're doing that, that's JavaScript. You're writing JavaScript. And the back tick is convenient because it means that you can write HTML within a string in kind of a more comfortable way than this old school string concatenation with all the like line breaks and like silly stuff. And it's all hail back ticks. Back ticks are great. But what you're lamenting is like that's not HTML.
like, that's not real HTML or whatever. Like, we used to be able to make the template part of a web component with actual HTML, right?
Yes. You used to author HTML. Now you're putting JavaScript and CSS inside, or sorry, HTML and CSS inside your JavaScript, just like all the other all-in JS approaches. So you literally write a style block inside your return tick, you know, template literal string. You write style blocks. And there are some nice features
That's another thing that we lose with HTML imports. HTML imports were literally a tag, like link, like you would be linking up a CSS file, but you're not. You're instead of rel equals style sheet, it's rel equals import. And then you link to an HTML file, and within that HTML file was the template, probably.
Yeah, it was a template with a style block and your HTML, and then below that was a script tag with all your, basically registering the component. Mm-hmm. Like,
and you could link to a style sheet there, too, so you didn't have to make a style block, I think, right? Maybe you'd have to make...
Yeah, you could link to other style sheets. You could link to other components. If you had child components, you could link to... you could link to a script file if you wanted, like if you had this big gnarly, you know, carousel or something. But now it's all JavaScript in ES6, which is that in your JavaScript file, or to load it, you do like script type equals module. And then inside that JavaScript file, you'll have import statements like import foo from foo.js or something. So.
Right, like classic, how we're used to writing JavaScript these days, which is probably Webpack packing all that stuff up, but is the standard thing and is making its way to browsers and is starting to land now, that all that JavaScript import stuff. Mm-hmm. In a sense, who cares what Polymer does, right? It's a big deal because the only person in the world, or the only company in the world that cared about was in on HTML imports was Google, and now that they're not even doing it, and Firefox for sure isn't doing it, and Edge for sure isn't doing it, HTML imports is dead, and it really will influence like native web components as well.
Yeah, I mean, like, basically the only way to do the link rel import in any browser other than Chrome is through some kind of polyfill, which basically looks for these import statements and injects them, mm-hmm. you know, into the DOM. I don't know, Chris. I'm a little bit peeved. I don't know. God forbid you'd want to write HTML in web components, but, you know, I guess we get to use JavaScript now. That's real cool.
Wow.
I'm not impressed, Chris. It's a very, like, minor change, and I understand why Polymer did it, because they, like, no one's picking up HTML.
That's how every other one of these frameworks works, is the thing.
Yeah.
Like, that's how React works, so...
Yeah, so I think they're just like, well, we got to, you know, just kind of, their whole thing is use the platform. And no, the platform is not using HTML or not supporting HTML imports. So they think, oh, we should, I guess we'll, you know, we have to, if we're abiding by this mantra, we have to use what's available. So, you know, it's a little bit of a bummer.
And there's bonuses. I mean, I could see someone reading this announcement being like, oh, this is way better. Like, I'm very familiar with React, so this makes more sense to me. I like it more.
Yeah. I mean, it may be a boon for a lot of people, but, you know, it's just, you know, like, you just want to make a website without, like, a bunch of JavaScript, you know? And I felt like that was the promise that Polymer and Web Components had, but now it just seems super...
It's a doubling down on JavaScript that you... don't love.
Yeah, I just write more JavaScript for the rest of my godforsaken development life, Chris.
So there's another thing you might be saying here is that some web components need no JavaScript at all. They're just like, I just want to invent a component that's styled in a particular way because that makes sense for my site in some way.
Chris, how about navigation?
Sure.
HTML. You know, it's like you have this static navigation. It's going to change once every 5 years, you know, like.
Right. And it makes sense in your like modular world or whatever to invent DaveNav. And now DaveNav cannot exist without JavaScript.
It can only exist in JavaScript, basically. I mean, there is talk. There is web components or GitHub www.ecosystem.com/w3c/webcomponents, and there's a discussion there about HTML modules, like leveraging this ES6 module into an HTML like import. But it's devolving into an ugly like syntax discussion, and then they're even like now we have to add MIME types to ES6 imports, you know, like you say import foo from foo.html as document fragment. You know, it's just starting to get like brutal. And if you imagine you like you webpack all that up, like now you got like a whole like 6-ton, I don't know, JavaScript file. The thing about Polymer was it like loaded exactly what you needed per page, you know. But if you're like packing or bundling, you know, you're now loading your whole entire, like, you know, I don't know, your Rails view folder in JavaScript, you know, in your JavaScript bundle. I'm fed up, Chris.
Unless you code split that baby up, but that's a whole
nother thing. You know, just turn on code splitting. Done. Just, we did it, Chris. I typed a flag and it works great.
All right, so
we should get Sean Larkin from Sean, if you're listening, mm-hmm. From Webpack to come on here and tell us about Webpack.
I did a screencast with him not so long at all. So that's on CSS Tricks. There's like a we sat and played with Webpack for a while. So we did not get to code splitting or anything. This was let's wrap our head around. Yeah, no, but it was just like it was just helping me understand it more, and I thought it was great. I really like, not that I like understand all of Webpack and what's possible with it now, but I definitely understand at a fundamental level.
I think it is interesting about Webpack and that people are now doing talks on it, you know, and they're explaining what loader magic is happening. Because I think people are realizing Webpack is just this file I copy paste from project to project, you know, and I hopefully copy paste the right, you know, key value pair into my config file to spit out the right thing. Mm-hmm. But now people, I think, are starting to break it down and be like, hey, what's this actually do and how's it do it?
Yeah, yeah.
Man. But anyway, Chris, I'm kind of upset. And can I add a double drama? Can I double down the KFC Shop Talk double down hot drama?
Yes.
I'm starting to wonder, you remember the Extensible Web Manifesto?
I do.
You remember that? Mm-hmm. Which is kind of this whole thing.
Houdini-esque now. Right.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of this big idea that we don't need high level things like new elements, like a bar chart element. You know, what we need is low level APIs like Houdini, service workers, these fetch. You know, yeah. Like we need low level things to that we can leverage and write wrappers and libraries around to produce things. My worry here is that one of the side effects of this extensible web manifesto is we're putting all this effort and development time into JavaScript APIs and building up JavaScript as a language and basically just leaving HTML to kind of just be stagnant and mm-hmm. not ever update. And they're always like, oh, well, we'll go back and we'll roll things in, you know? That's fair, but you know, like container queries, you know, there's large developer sentiment around it. There are hundreds of libraries that do this. It's rolled out on thousands of sites, but still it's like, well, have you tried Resize Observer? Because we built you a low-level API about it. And it's like, that's not it. That's just window.resize, but a fancy one. And so it's frustrating, Chris. I don't know. I just feel like JavaScript is progressing, and that's okay. Like it should. Like ES6 modules are great, but like at the sake of HTML, I think that's silly.
No, maybe it'll all come around. I mean, I would think if there was like a Vegas style bet on this thing, that by 2019 we'll be writing container queries. The web's moving.
Think, yeah. 2019, Chris Quare says, 2019, we are writing native container queries.
We are, or at least there'll be like conference talks about it and stuff. Like the web will have,
like it's coming. Yeah, like it's on the horizon.
It'll be like a hot topic again, but like a hot topic that because of our good reason. Not.
Oh, you want to put a month on what month?
I'll take an early month.
I'm putting February. A reminder.
February.
February 1st. February 1st. February 14th. I'll give you Valentine's Day.
Okay.
And we're going to start a Vegas betting pool.
Yeah.
Over under on February 14th, 2019. Container queries are a thing. I'm literally adding.
I had one that just came by on my calendar that was. It was a claim chowder that said, "Did on my calendar it says, does CSS still matter?" Which was just, I knew that it was just a silly one on purpose because it was during the height of all that like CSS and JavaScript just starting, which is still just a fascinating thing that's happening. But remember, we even had a big Shop Talk show on it in the early days of it about it. And there was, you know, somebody at some point said, you know, mark my words, a year from now, CSS will be old school, you know, nobody will use it anymore. And I was just like, oh, please. So it went on the calendar. Anyway,
I got
one more thing that I have to talk about regarding HTML and just all this stuff that we're talking about. And it's about HTML imports, but not like I feel like everybody's mind when they think HTML imports, they're like, oh, I know what you mean. I have this HTML file and I want to import another little chunk of HTML within this other HTML. It's something, it's like the first abstraction that ever happened on the web. Like, I talk about this in a workshop I'm giving soon because it's like our job sometimes as front-end developers is a lot of times it's just like chopping up a design. It's like just chopping up, like, here's the design. Oh, I need to chop up the nav into a bit. Maybe I'll even chop up the links of the nav into a bit if I'm really chopping stuff up really finely. I'm going to chop up these cards. I'm going to chop up the footer. I'm going to chop up an article component. I'm going to chop up, you know, all this stuff. And that's just a basic content site. We're thinking of ways to split the HTML into little pieces like that. And then whatever CMS we use, whatever backend framework we use, whatever we use, we're piecing those pieces back together. That's even how React works and web components works. Our job is about splitting stuff up into little chunks. So like, why can't HTML, just regular old HTML, help with that? Like, not in a fancy web components way, in a way, like, why isn't there, like, an include HTML element? Like, left bracket, include, href, boom. Like can somebody explain to me why that doesn't exist? It seems like we've been doing that for, like, over a decade, wanting to, like, piece together a little piece of it. And so we've had to rely on PHP or a Ruby statement or like some grunt file to piece it together, or, you know, that's why we use React now. Why can't regular old HTML have just like an import statement?
Yep. I think that touches on the HTML imports. I mean, the whole thing about Firefox and their Bugzilla was like, writing an importer is hard, you know, like you have HTML.
Is that why? Is because it's basically there's complication there that I don't understand.
Yeah, well, that we don't understand, and because we're plebs and Mozilla, it's probably a hard problem. But it's like if we figured out ES6 modules, which is like, you know, recursive module inclusion, we can do that in HTML.
Or maybe it's like a philosophical thing. You know, people talk about how HTML is like fault tolerant, you know, and if there's a little mistake, it just like rolls on anyway. And I wonder if imports like is fundamentally breaks that.
Right, like the non-backwards compat. But, you know, it's easy to write a polyfill for, you know.
I don't know. I've just always wanted that. I think of early sites I made where the only reason I use PHP at all is because I only needed that one thing.
Oh man, I mean, that's like why I use Jekyll. Sure, you know, yeah. Like, why? I mean, what would I use Jekyll for? Like, you know, it does not. It's, I guess, writing in Markdown is nice, you know, but I could also do that.
Yeah, it's like header, content, footer. Why can't I do that native way? Okay, that's a rant.
Sorry, we're all getting 20 minutes here. Like taking it a step further, why doesn't HTML have something like mustache or, you know, just a for loop to loop through a JSON or something. And I realize I'm kind of mixing like data and HTML. Like HTML is just presentation, not logic, you know, but it just, what is our job? You know, it's spitting out lists of crap and then spitting out blog posts, you know, that's what everyone does, or products or whatever. Like, that's what we do all the time. That's like the core thing that all of us are doing, and it just it's weird that we aren't working on like a language feature, you know, like nunchucks or whatever from Mozilla. Why isn't that on a path to be a DOM API or just be like native, you know? I don't know. I'm losing it. Anyway, so on that note, this was from the Polymer Summit, kind of tying a bow on this. They kind of mentioned this, really, it's nascent, it's really brand new, it's a baby repo, but lit HTML is what it's called. I'll post a link in the old show notes, but
HTML template literals in JavaScript,
and so it's basically JSX but using template literals, and it's like a render function. And this is kind of how Polymer is doing their rendering, you know, their templates. But it's pretty cool.
Is it?
I don't know.
Like, why not like, JSX? What's wrong with JSX?
Well, JSX has to get transpiled into something. This is JavaScript. So, like JSX is kind of a weird, like, legacy dude.
I know that it gets
converted. It's kind of a creepy uncle next to like a pool.
I thought it was cool because it's not React, right? It's its own separate project. You can use it all by itself. But what does it turn into? It turns into like document.createElement and nested.
I think so. I think it has to be like transpiled. And the browsers may do that, like some weird XML feature that they had, you know. I'm not sure how it exactly works, but again, we should probably get somebody like Sean Larkin to explain.
I know. I think it's fun how we, because sometimes we get criticism by the way. So I'm sure somebody's listening out there is like, why are they just spitballing it here when they should probably have somebody who knows what they're talking about on here? Well, that's part of the charm of Shop Talk Show, isn't it? Isn't it sometimes refreshing to listen to people talk about things that they don't actually know every detail of it? They're just a developer struggling through like you.
Yeah, they're kind of like
And we want to do both. Like, I want those people on the show too, and hopefully we'll do both of those things.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think, I don't know. I feel like we're an informed opinion, Chris, but maybe, you know, not experts, and that's fine. It's like remember life pre-Wikipedia where you just had to guess things?
Yeah. Honestly, I think about that too often because, you know, I'm having a daughter. Like, she will never wonder about anything ever. She'll just look it up. In fact, we might even not look it up. We already have the Alexa all over our house. So you don't even have to be troubled to walk over somewhere. You just wonder something just briefly, and you're like, Alexa, who is Yogi Berra? You know, boom.
Yeah. And Alexa's like, the first mayor of Azerbaijan. You're like, perfect.
Thank you. Yogi Berra liked picnic baskets. And she'll be like, oh, I understand now. This is actually cool, lit HTML. I get it. It really is just JavaScript because of the template literals. Like, it now that, yeah, this is cool.
Yeah.
It's like maybe it will replace JSX someday if you don't need to.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems very, again, back to that use the platform thing. You know, it seems very, very smart. So.
But why do you need it then? I still have to figure it out a little bit.
Well, I think this is Polymer's, like, how are we going to now move templates into JavaScript, you know, into modules and not use JSX. So what's the most convenient way to write HTML? And their whole thing is like, you can echo variables, like, you know, we don't have to parse that. That's like it has like H1 $ squiggly bracket this dot title. So, and then like, so it can, template literals can echo out variables. And so It's kind of...
But that's template literal. That's like a native. That's it already can do that. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to figure out what this thing does that's beyond it putting HTML in a template literal with variables inside of it. Template literals can already do that.
Yeah, no, I think it's just a 2K wrapper, like kilobyte wrapper around like a render function. So, okay. And, you know, maybe there's, I don't know. I think it can take objects and pass props and all that junk too. But
yeah, I see it. Like it doesn't do much.
Doesn't do much. And I think that's kind of how I like to roll. So I, in my day to day job, I try to not do much.
I guess I'll put the link to this in the show notes so people can for sure find it. Oh, you already did. Cool.
I'm there.
Today's episode is brought to you by Rollbar. Dealing with JavaScript errors is the worst, right? You have to rely on users to report errors or you like stare endlessly at some log file of errors. This is a problem solved with Rollbar. Rollbar detects when code breaks in real time and provides a stack trace and diagnostic data to help you debug those JavaScript errors. You can integrate it. It can alert you in Slack if something goes wrong, or it can just start logging issues for you. A few cool features I want to tell you about. You can upload your source maps and get stack traces, like meaningful stack traces, while still using minified JavaScript in production. It'll like tell you like what line your problem is on. And then they have JavaScript telemetry, which gives you a timeline of the events leading up to the error occurring. So you're not just finding the error, you're finding things that are happening up into that moment. And you can reduce noise in your log files and all that with a check ignore and filter out any values sent to their API. So you can just say, hey, I don't want to, if there's an error like this, or you can just ignore it whole hog. That's pretty cool. There's a special offer for Shop Talk Show listeners. Go to rollbar.com/shoptalkshow, all one word, sign up, and you get the Bootstrap plan free. That's free. So there you go. It's loved by companies like Heroku, Blue Apron, Twilio, Kayak, Zendesk, Twitch. So your boss will be like, oh, they use it, I can use it. So give Rollbar a try today. Go to rollbar.com/shoptalkshow, all one word, and get that free Bootstrap plan.
Let's see. Now for something completely different, as they say. These are totally unrelated questions to what we were just talking about. Yavinna Bryant. That was probably incorrect.
Nailed it.
What would it cost a large corporation? Example, large corporation being like Martha Living. Like a Martha Living being a magazine and an online brand and products and all this stuff. Certainly Martha Living Omnimedia Inc. is huge. What would it cost a large corporation like that to integrate a podcast system for their subscribers? What are some of the providers and programs and costs for this service? So it's a pretty specific business question, but I found it kind of interesting. Like, you know, what if you were asked, Dave, if you're in this market, like, you know, you're working with a big brand. You're not working with, you know, Joe Schmo wants to start a podcast here. They have to think a little bit more corporate-y, I guess. They want to start a podcast, how would they do it? I mean, it's going to be hard for us to spitball a cost here, but like, what do you think about?
Okay, let's see. What would it cost? This is tough. It's like, you know, if you take the Dan Moll approach, it's kind of like, what's it worth to you? You know? You know, podcasting is cheap. Chris, you and I mean, you can be very expensive podcasts too. Like there's Gimlet Media, there's like, and then there's the other end, which is just us kind of spitballing into microphones over Skype. And we hand that off to a producer, Chris Enns, who kind of makes it, stitches it together and fixes it up. I don't know that costs money, and it's like a weekly, monthly thing.
People maybe. I mean, I guess what occurs to me is that when you're talking about Gimlet and stuff, the costs there aren't so much the cost of a microphone. In fact, not long ago, I bought new microphone equipment and stuff. I'm not even speaking into it right now because I'm tearing down my house because I'm moving across the country, you know, so I'm speaking into kind of my backup mic here. So, but I'll be back on my new really good microphone soon. That was like, I think I called it the sub-$1,000 setup, which was like, you can get a lot, you know, and to that's nothing to, you know, Martha Stewart is going to buy you a really nice microphone. That's not your major cost. Technology wise, it could or could not be expensive and difficult. I don't know what the CMS situation is like you got going over there. Is it a really nice CMS that's really flexible and ready to go? If it is, make a new content type kind of situation for a podcast episode, write whatever filters and output action you need to output a page for a podcast episode, and another one that creates an RSS feed for a podcast. Remember, that's all a podcast is a specially formatted RSS feed. And, you know, iTunes, Apple puts out documentation that's very clear on what you need to include for it to be like an iTunes ready feed, which you pretty much have to do because iTunes kind of rules the podcast market. Although, you know, whatever, I'm sure we could talk about that some more. But as long as your CMS can barf out an RSS feed in that thing, you're ready to go. So what I think if you're going to make a really good podcast, what's going to cost money is the human beings involved. Are you going to make it somebody's job to produce this podcast and be the host of the podcast? Are you talking a whole team of a dozen people or something? The people in that case are going to be 10x the expensive part of this. It's not the microphones. It's not the technology. It's the doubling down on the content and it's organizational change to get ready for this podcast that's going to cost the money.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, like a, Martha Living, you know, like some big thing, you're probably going to do different podcasts too, probably like 3-4 shows that you're, you know, trying to like basically become a radio
right.
program, you know, you're trying to do multiple shows a week. You know, you've got to record. That's 1 hour. You got to mix it down. That takes me 6 to 8 hours. If I'm being like cutting out ums and you knows and all that, if you're fine with those, you can maybe 2 to 3 hours. So every show you're producing takes at least one person 4 hours to capture and
edit. I think you're right. It'll be multiple shows. Cause wouldn't that be weird for Martha Stewart to release a podcast, one podcast in which the host is not Martha Stewart? I think the chances are you're probably not going to get Martha Stewart to be the host of this podcast. That, you know, it'll more like be, you know, here's Home Living with Samantha
B.
There you go. Carter or something. And like, you know, Baking Tidbits with Bobby Bill Master. God, that's
Bobby Flay. No, I think that's it. I think like you probably want like 3 or 4 shows for something like this. We're doing free consulting for Martha Living. But, you know, I think it's at least 4 hours a show. That's half a day. So you're going to have somebody kind of full time ish to do that in case things go wrong or there's some random requests. You know, posting it on the website takes 30 minutes, you know. But the cost, you know, we use Simplecast. That's like $100 a year or something. You know, it's probably a little bit 120 ish. So I think $10 a month. So, yeah, I mean, it costs money, but that the hard costs in equipment and hosting are pretty low compared to what you were saying, Chris, like the talent. Like what does it cost to get Bobby Flay to come in and talk for an hour about cooking on a podcast? I don't know. It probably costs, I would say, I don't know. It's probably expensive is what I'm thinking. So.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, that's probably about as good of an answer as we can dig up here, because neither of us have quite been in that situation before.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably like speaker's fee sort of thing, but maybe they also want to do a podcast. So you could probably find people who do that, you know, like we want to do a podcast. So, you know, we're cheap labor if we want to do a podcast. So, yeah, I don't know.
Charlie Meisner. Sorry, Charlie. Hi, guys. I'm a structural engineer and aspiring web developer in Seattle. I'm building a web app to help engineers perform common structural engineering calculations. Cool. This app has an Angular front end and a Django REST API in the back end. Also cool. I intend to deploy the app with Heroku. My understanding is that there's two approaches I can take. Number one, use Nginx as a reverse proxy, allowing communication between the server and the client. Two, deploy two separate Heroku instances, one for the API and the second one for the Angular app. The front end would be hosted at like myapp.com and make requests to myapp.com/API. Now for my question is one of these approaches better than the other? Is one approach more secure than the other? And he says he's using Angular 4 and Angular CLI. So what, there's two things going on here. There's this Angular app, you know, presumably a, who knows, Webpack and all the stuff that goes into a kind of stack like that. And then a Django, which is a Python app, right, with that is dealing with the REST API and the URLs involved with that. So, you know, I guess different routers and different, these are pretty different stacks, right?
Yeah, that's it's kind of a lot of pieces there. For me, you know, you can spin up like other processes on the same server. But it doesn't always work well, you know, I have a Mastodon instance that did not do so well on Heroku because it needs a Rails streaming server API it needs Rails to run the app, and then it needs a streaming server API to in Node to kind of basically handle like broadcasting, like, hey, there's been it's basically like a living JSON document, you know, like a updating JSON document. And I really wasn't able to get it off the ground, and that was kind of a super bummer. And I wish I could have, but it just didn't work out that way. So, I guess I would say do multiple domains with like subdomains. Does that make sense? Have like
subdomains is better than, because he says myapp.com and myapp.com/API. That seems more sketchy than api.myapp.com.
Yeah, because you almost need like a server or something in front of it to kind of route that. But if you are using subdomains, it should, you know, if, because they sound like totally different apps. So I think if you're, yeah, you do need a reverse proxy to basically figure out who's doing what. But if you don't, you just need like a DNS configuration, you know, if you have subdomains. And that's probably the way I would approach it with something like Heroku. So just do subdomains.
Subdomain seems to make sense for me. But we're saying two separate instances makes more sense, right? It feels better.
Yeah.
I would agree too. I mean, it's easier to diagnose what's going wrong, I think, in that kind of situation. And you can like scale them separately as needed. It seems to make more sense. But to be fair, I don't really understand number one, which was use Nginx as reverse proxy, allowing communication between server and client. I don't know why that's, I guess I just don't understand that sentence.
Yeah. I guess you'd like do some URL rewrites or something, like, or like, all requests to this go to this port or whatever. I would just rely on DNS and kind of treat it as two different projects. You have the big API, the brain, and then you have the front end. I think in that way it's decoupled and it should be, you know, it's not.
Yeah. I mean, you're decoupling your whole, all your thinking right now is decoupling. You've decoupled your front end and your back end. Why don't you keep decoupling at the server level?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then you're set up for, you know, native apps and stuff like that. Like, they just have to hit the API. It's not, you know, you're not going to, like, topple over your website if, like, you know, if the, you know, AP or, like, the iPhone client is acting like a, you know, a bot attacking your net, your website. So it's just hitting your API, but hopefully those are super good cached things, so. Anyway, that's how I do it. DNS is a powerful, powerful tool. So
cool.
All right, I got a question for you, Chris. Yep. I got an audio question here from David. Here we go.
Hey, I have a question about using Redux and really any other utility library with OG plain HTML and JavaScript. No frameworks, and especially no Webpack. Nothing bundling everything up. So if you're not using Webpack and you can't do stuff like import create store from Redux into just any old file, because it you don't have all your node modules being pulled into your website anywhere unless you explicitly do that using like Browserify or something. So Dave, for you've been doing some web component stuff, so like if you want to use Redux, do you just use a script that pulls in the Redux library, and do you, I don't know, like it's you know, and right. This doesn't have to work.
I know,
in anything.
You know, David, you asked Dave, but this comes up for me regularly, especially as somebody who runs CodePen. People like have this question a lot. Like, I can't, like, whatever. If you're looking at anything at all that references Redux or things like it, the documentation and stuff will be like, yes, you know, import create store from Redux. And people think when they see a statement like that, they think Webpack immediately, because Webpack totally can digest that and knows exactly what to do with that. And that is something that we're used to, like, oh, where did Redux come from? Oh, it's because I NPM installed Redux and it's just available in this project. That's all true. But that import statement is not a Webpack statement. It is a native thing, and we were just talking about that. It's starting to arrive in browsers. So at some point, you will be able to import create store from Redux in JavaScript and have that just work in a browser, although it won't be exactly like that, because I think you'll have to, it won't be buried in your node modules folder at that point. You'll probably have your own file structure of where you've put Redux, or you'll have to, if you are using NPM, you'll have to like, you know, put a relative file path there to where that file goes, because, you know, the browser doesn't know about your node modules folder or whatever. But you can do that, you know, like I would at this point, you're still in Webpack land, but you don't have to write import create store from Redux. Like, all you're doing there is making a global variable called create store in which for you to use. That's what that statement is actually doing. What you need is create store. And that's what, you know, a lot of these libraries, Redux included, they ship a distribution version of Redux that's intentionally ready to be used in multiple ways. And that's called UMD, right, Dave?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the point of UMD is that it's ready to be used as it's importable, it's requireable, and if you want to just load it up in the browser, it can do that too. So, like, if you ever see, like, a, I don't know, it's like a, how does it start in JavaScript files? You see this, like, function global factory and then type of export equals object. There's, like, this weird, bizarre-looking JavaScript pattern that if you use this weird pattern and then wrap up all your code inside of it, it's, like, ready to go to be digested in lots of different formats, including just linked up in a script tag right in the browser. So if you want to use Redux and you don't want to use Webpack, you can use the distributed version of Redux, just redux.js, just load it up in a script tag, and it should create the global that you need, which is create store, right?
I think so. I'm trying to like verify this, but yeah, like it's going to export something and then you should have access to it. But with the ES6 modules, you can just import from the file like redux.js, because that's all it is. So you can use it locally. I guess if you're trying to do super compat, you know, you're going to production, you will have to pack it at some point. But I'm just, let me, I just want to just take a code pen for a spin. So,
yeah, I did it quick too. Let's see, like, what global do you get when you just load up redux.js? Like, what does it give you?
Yeah. I wonder if it, what it exports.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, it exports something, but it also probably is just like, makes a global of some sort that you need to use.
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
Live coding here on the Shop Talk.
This is really fun. Yeah, it makes a capital letter Redux global. Like capital R Redux. And it's got create store in it and compose and combine reducers, apply middleware, and bind action creator. So if you want to use Redux in that way, you can do it that way. And the same file is ready to be used with Webpack or with native ES6 includes and all that stuff. That's kind of the beauty of the UMD thing. Or it can't be required, right? Requires a different format. You got to have like the CJS file or whatever. Oh, that's why it's so complicated. You just want to write a little library and people are like, it needs to work in Bower. It needs to be work in Node. It needs to work in the browser. It needs to work in my Webpack. And you got to distribute like six versions of your stupid thing.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I was kind of running into this. I made a little thing that loops through your Google Analytics, like an export, like a CSV of your browsers, and basically turns Chrome 59.0.12345 and Chrome 59.0.45678. Like it reduces that down to Chrome 59. So you get kind of a good,
oh, nice,
you know, like view of how your website or like what your browsers are. And I'm like struggling with like the export, like how I should do that. Like, cause it can basically, I want it to be just used from the command line, but I also want it to be used, which is kind of what we're talking about here. Like just, you know, do this and I'm going to pass you a thing and then you're going to spit a thing out. But I also like, oh, it'd be nice in a Node module, you know, something to spit things out. So, you know, it's weird.
UMD, dude.
Yeah. Yeah. Probably need like a both. But you can also export like a function that you have referenced and then, yeah, this is tough. It's tough to, we should have done our homework, but it seems like I have access to react.createStore in here. So then I just need to create a store, and offhand I'm like failing at this. So, or sorry, redux.createStore. So yeah, I was just like, oh, I'm going to create a store and everyone's going to think it's amazing, but it's a little more.
Well, it's
convoluted than that.
It's doable, though, isn't it? I mean, the APIs are there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's all. I have access to the function, so it's gonna work. So.
And now you're pretty soon. You'll be dispatching and subscribing. It's gonna be great.
Yep, I'm gonna try it. Let store equals Redux that create store. Create store. What I need a variable there, right? Or something. that's a function. I hate this. Anyway, I quit live coding. I'm going to
just copy something from the docs.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, you'll have to namespace everything because it doesn't, it'll be different. It'll all be redux.createStore, not just createStore. Okay, anyway, let's do another one.
Question from Jonas calls in.
Hi. Do you know a way to serve different video files depending on the screen resolution? Like, if you have an EMG tag with a source that you can have different images depending on the screen resolution. But if I have a video tag, I don't want to like serve a 4K video to a mobile phone holding portrait mode. It's just unnecessary data to be shipped. So I just wanted to know if you know a solution to it. Bye.
It's a super good question, I think.
Yeah. So here's, I don't know where it's at. But the picture tag was modeled after the video tag. So your sources in video source, you know, something.webm, something.mp4, could have media attributes at min width, you know, 320 pixels, use this small one at min width, you know, there, you could actually, you know, do this, you know, basically you could serve different media files based on
right.
the
which is cool. So we're talking about, you know, left bracket video, like the video tag within it, you're saying there's this thing called source. So there's a left bracket source, right bracket. It's like it's an actual HTML tag. And the purpose of it was to have multiple sources for one video. So you could have an AUG one in there, but if the browser didn't support AUG, there's an MP4 there, or there's a WebM or WebV, I don't know, whatever. There's multiple sources there and the browser will pick one, which is really cool. And you're right, Dave. I think that, I forgot about that, but the picture element was modeled after the video element, but then picture took it so much further and you could do so much cool stuff with it. And then I don't think that stuff made it back to video. I don't think you can do any of that fancy picture stuff in video yet.
Yeah, well, and I think video even deprecated that feature. I think it probably still works in a lot of browsers, maybe all of them, but I think it was deprecated. So that's a bummer. I think the way to, like, the technical way to handle it is a streaming server. Do you think, I mean, which is brutal, but the way these videos and stuff are encoded, they can send you less bytes, you know, like the, like, you know how YouTube does like 240 resolution, 720,
yeah,
you know,
like
a proper streaming server should be able to do on the fly, like decoding and basically dropping bytes and things like that.
What I thought of right away was Cloudinary, and which is not a sponsor of this thing, although Cloudinary, please sponsor us. It's a pretty good service, and they're kind of known for photo stuff a lot. But one of the beauties of it is I can just link. You can give me, Dave, you can give me a 4,000 pixel wide JPEG, and I'll just upload it to Cloudinary, and then it'll give me a URL for that JPEG. Great, and I can serve it, and it's on a CDN, and there's all those benefits too. But it has these like URL parameters that I can serve that JPEG with, and one of them is like format auto. So it'll be like, oh, you know what? You're in Chrome, I can tell, or whatever. You should get a like a WebP, because I can smash this JPEG smaller with WebP than I can with JPEG. So we're just going to do that on our end and serve it to you as WebP, and it's going to work. We just know it will, because we can just tell. Or like you're in Firefox, you're going to get like JPEG 2000 or whatever that weird format is. It can do all this like intelligent stuff that would be a huge pain in the butt with the picture element. Like you could do it all natively. It's just you're going to have to make a million versions of it. You have to make a million sizes of it. You're just going to not do as good of a job as a service that automatically does it can handle for you. It's really great. And you can also say, adjust the quality for me too, and adjust the size for what's appropriate, all this great stuff. It can do all that stuff with video too. So like even if you could do this stuff with native stuff, it's almost like, gosh, you know, this is where web services really shine.
Mm-hmm.
You can say quality audio or quality auto and format auto with a movie that you upload, and it'll just work everywhere and be the right size, and it'll just know about the device and stuff. It's great. And it'll get better over time as like stuff like client hints gets better. They get better.
Well, there you go. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of where I was getting, like a service. Like, I mean, YouTube, you don't quite own your content, or Vimeo, you know, you're putting it on somewhere, but like, but they do a lot of this making it work on other browsers for you. So, unfortunately, I hate to like recommend third party. You should always publish your own stuff, but, they do a lot of this negotiation for you. But, yeah, Cloudinary is a good little service. I didn't realize they could do video kind of on the fly, you know. They basically,
yeah, I think it's a good move for them, because not a lot of places do that. They definitely like have competitors like Imgix in the image department.
Yeah,
but not so much in video.
Oh,
and there's all these statistics. Have you ever heard that thing like by 2020, you know, half of everything ever will be video? I can't remember this. I don't know. That was a terrible anecdote, but because I can't remember, it was half of what? Half, like, we won't look at images anymore. It'll just be all video. Kind of, I think, is the insinuation. Anyway, good luck, Jonas.
JW player, that very cool
old school,
like old school video player. They have like a hosting platform too, like that does all this stuff too. So, I'd consider going indie and owning your video there.
Today's episode is brought to you by cross-browser testing. Let's say you're building a website on a Mac and you need to test it in Edge. You don't have Edge. What do you do? Vice versa. You're building a website on Windows. You need to test it in Safari. You don't have a Mac, so you can't test Safari. What do you do? That's where cross-browser testing comes in. You fire it up. It's like a website. You go to the website, crossbrowsertesting.com. You fire it up and you can start testing on just like hundreds, maybe thousands of devices. It's just, it's awesome. And you get access to dev tools inside the browser, inside this like emulator virtual machine thingy that they got running. I don't even know what the technology is, but you can start debugging. You can even debug your local host in a browser using another browser. It's so cool, and you got to check this out. You know, it's if you need to test your sites, I use Edge. If you're not testing your site in Edge, guess what? I'm seeing your mistakes. So you need to make sure that you're testing everything in every browser, especially for your clients and your bosses and your production websites. There's another cool feature. There's a lot of cool features about cross-browser testing. I can't get to them all today, but one thing is, if let's say you just want to make sure you made a big change, you want to make sure you didn't mess something up, they can do like a screenshot sort of thing where they like take screenshots in dozens of different browsers and just show you like a snapshot of your site to make sure you didn't just mess up the homepage with a fancy, fancy hero. This is really critical technology as a web developer. So head over to crossbrowsertesting.com or click the link in the show notes and start using it today.
All right, here we go. Oh, I lost the window. Darr. Here we go. We did. Hi, guys. Charlie Meisner.
No, we did Charlie, didn't we?
We did Charlie. Sorry, Charlie. That's right. That's the app. Professional here. Podcast. Ross Whitehouse writes in. Hey, guys. I picked up your podcast on a recommendation from a friend. Really enjoyed it. You're talking about desktop machines versus laptops. Made me wonder something. This was episode 273. I'm a young front-end developer in work for just over 2 years now. I'm 22 and soon to be moving in with my partner of 3 years. Nice. My university course, while not incredibly broad technically, taught me skills to learn new languages and technologies with a greater passion. As such, I try to continuously learn and expand my knowledge base, CodePen, CSS tricks, all that. My question involves that work-life balance you talked about. How do you guys find time to do a 9-to-5 job, have a personal life, and continue to learn new things? I tried to get a couple of Udemy View tutorials under my belt at least every couple days, but I can only imagine with my new live-in partner, it'll become even harder. Tips appreciated. Chris? You recently, more recently than me, became a combined household. So
yeah, I mean, it's a couple years ago now, but I've always, I don't know, work like, you know, does it, I've always been so like, this is what I do. This is my thing. It's not like I'm inflexible as a human being, but this is my career. This is my passion. This is my, you know, this is the way bills get paid around here. This computer is kind of my life. I think that it's not particularly hard if you're honest and sincere about those things that you can set some boundaries that are like, you know, allow that work-life balance to happen, you know?
Yeah. For me, having a dedicated space, like, which is my shed, has added a lot to the work-life balance. That has been a big deal because, you know, I leave work there. I'm not like, I do kind of tinker on computers on the couch now. You know, I have a laptop, a nice little Surface Book, but I tinker with websites, but it's mostly because like my kids are watching like the Backyardigans for like the 400th time, you know, it's like, I cannot watch, I don't need to see Minions again, you know? And so I'm just going to kind of tinker on a CodePen or my website or something. But it's harder because it's like 6.5 minutes. And then my kids are asking me for like something from the fridge, you know, it's like, you know, that it's, it doesn't last long. Like the moments are very, what I think I've learned is I try to keep it in there. At Paravel, it was kind of Reagan's, we're three person, Trent, Dave, and Reagan. Reagan kind of put his foot down and was just like, we do not slack after like 6 o'clock unless like your arm fell off or, you know, or like you're vomiting and won't be into work or something. Like, don't slack after hours. Like the office is closed. And I think that's helped out too, because Trent and I are kind of young and dumb, or at least were. And like, we would just, you know, try to field things at all hours of the day, you know, and then so it just was causing stress because some people don't want to talk about websites at 9 p.m. and, you know, or 11 when they're going to bed. So that's helped too, is like setting parameters, you know, and set, having a space that you do this.
There's probably a middle ground there where you're like, I don't do that. So I have my Slack set up to not, and my expectation is that nobody expects from me anything at these hours, you know?
Yeah.
Not because I'm trying to defend my own usage, but sometimes like if I'm on at 9 and I need to leave a note for somebody, I want to just do it, get it out of my brain right now. And I might drop it in Slack. I don't expect you to do anything with it. I just need to put it somewhere.
Right. And that's, I think it's, you kind of just establish the parameters, you know, and there'll be times we drop something in, you know, but like just establish the parameters and like, if it's after hours, it does not matter, you know, or like it can wait till tomorrow, you know? I think that's a big thing. I think like with your partner, moving in with your partner, I think you just, this is kind of communication relationships 101, but like, you know, it will feel like every time you want to just like, you know, watch a course or tinker or something, you're kind of like stealing time away from your partner, you know, but hopefully your partner has hobbies that they're into. They can, you know, but if they don't and they kind of just want to hang out with you and chill and watch Netflix or whatever, like you kind of got just do that. I don't know. I think be happy with your partner. That's kind of
a good idea too. I mean, we haven't, I don't know. I think these things evolve over time and they kind of come and go and whatever is necessary at the time to make sure that you're both happy. But we've toyed around with a like, okay, no distractions during the day. Let's try that out. But then at night, like no distractions the other way either.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that, which is a kind of a firm boundary, which I kind of appreciate. I'd like to, like we thought of this idea just recently of something that we want to try. And then we're like, well, but now we're moving and there's a million things going on. So it's like, we haven't tried it out perfectly yet, but I look forward to trying that out. Like a 100% separation thing, like step back in the door. Computers are done for the day.
Yeah, you just close it up. Or like you, I mean, you're very intentional. You're just like, this is something I want to work on this thing right now. I'm going to open my computer, announce it. I don't know. And then like, and there's also studies to show like hashtag relationship advice. Like don't take screens into the bedroom. Just, you know, as some people do that and it's great. But like, I think just in general, like the advice is, that becomes kind of a distraction. So, you know, hey, we're all grown ups here. So, but yeah, just have some boundaries with your devices and your website. Cause I think that's the thing too, is if you're starting consulting or whatever, you're going to get like little emails and dings at like 9 o'clock. And it's just like, maybe don't, you know, just wait for it. Let it go till tomorrow. So that's all I got.
Nice place to end it.
All right. Well, hey, thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher choice. Be sure to star, heart, favorite it up. That's how people find out about the show, and y'all have been doing such a great job at it. We really appreciate it. If you want to follow us on Twitter, or follow us at Shop Talk Show on Twitter for tens of tweets a month. And if you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one, because people want to hire people like you. And Chris, do you have anything else you'd like to say?
Shop Talk Show.